And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And yes, it is a great day for the Republican Party, believe it or not. And a great day for the leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, Speaker Mike Johnson. Why? Because they're getting off the dime. They have now announced today, earlier today, that they will be voting on a desperately needed aid to Ukraine, to Israel, and to Taiwan. That will come in three separate bills. They have all been passed and authorized already by the Senate, and this should go through. We will get to that. We will also get to the threat that from the president of Iran that even the tiniest invasion by Israel, he said, would bring a massive and harsh response as the region braces for potential Israeli retaliation. That for that unprecedented drone and missile attack on Israel over the weekend. There is, meanwhile, a great deal of controversy regarding the Biden administration's handling of the entire Israel situation. A powerful and extremely persuasive editorial in the Wall Street Journal about how President Biden, by basically pressuring Israel rather than pressuring Hamas with some American-based consequences, that he has actually made it impossible to reach an agreement with Hamas of any kind to get out some surviving hostages, including those five American citizens who are among the hostages being held and mistreated by Hamas. There's also a stunning revelation about an increase in anti-Semitism in the last year, particularly since October 7th. Is that really anti-Semitism, or is it just anti-Zionism? Well, again, given the fact that Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, the idea that there is a distinction between the two of them, dubious. And speaking of dubious, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday about one of the bills that has helped to imprison some of the rioters from January 6th. And that might actually, it appears from what the justices said and the way that they dealt with some of the questions on the table, that the Supreme Court of the United States may overturn the basis from a 2003 piece of legislation then on which the convictions of a number of the rioters were actually achieved. So there may be basis to reduce charges and perhaps even release early from imprisonment some of the participants in the January 6th riots. Okay, that may occur. And if it does, what would be the impact on the charges against Trump once he moves beyond the hush money trial, which, by the way, is in recess today? They've now chosen seven jurors, and we know something about them. We certainly don't know their names. We will bring you up to date on that. We'll be speaking to John Hugh, perhaps one of the, not perhaps, definitely one of the most respected and revered conservative legal scholars in the country. And there's new polling, and brand new polling, and it all shows the same direction, which is Trump losing a few points, Biden gaining a few points. President Biden and former President Trump are now neck and neck, according to the Hill Decision Desk headquarters, the latest average of polls released this morning. According to an average of all polls across the board, Trump right now has 45.1% support. Biden has 45.1%. 0.1% support. This based on an average of 658 polls pitting the two against each other in a likely 2024 matchup. We will also be speaking with Molly Ball, who has written a much-noted piece in the Wall Street Journal, a piece about Biden making the mistake, and perhaps fatal mistake for his chances of reelection, of focusing not on the middle, which is the voters he needs to win, voters he won last time, but focusing on his party's left wing, which is angry with him, as people are pretty much all over the map right now about his handling of the crisis in the Middle East and the war between Hamas and Israel. Okay, first up, the announcement from the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. Speaker Mike Johnson let it be known today, just hours ago, that he is sticking with his plan to put a series of foreign aid bills on the floor of the House, including funding for Ukraine, after facing significant pressure from hardliners in his own party. Johnson said in a note to members, that's Republican members, that they will vote on these authorizations of this foreign aid. It totals $95 billion. That people will vote on this on Saturday evening. Johnson said in his note, after significant member feedback and discussion, the House Rules Committee will be posting soon today the text of three bills that will fund America's national security interests and support allies in Israel, the Indo-Pacific, and Ukraine, including a loan structure for aid and enhanced strategy and accountability, Johnson said in the note. In other words, one of the things that he is conceding is that much of the aid to Ukraine will be repayable. In other words, it will be based as a loan, not simply as a gift. The three-part supplemental package looks strikingly similar to the Senate's bill in several key ways, including the package includes a little more than $9 billion in humanitarian aid for Gaza and other conflict zones around the world, which had been a red line for Democrats. The bills all taken together also add up to about $95 billion in aid, the same amount the Senate bill included, with an adjustment that $10 billion in Ukraine economic assistance is in the form of a repayable loan. The specific assistance is the kind of direct payment that helps Ukraine's government continue to function during a war. Multiple Republicans say they oppose any funding for Ukraine, meaning that a significant share of Democrats will be required to carry the measure over the finish line. Nearly all the Democrats in the House of Representatives support this. And maybe a small majority, 55% or 60% of the House Republicans support this. It will pass, but that doesn't mean that people from the Freedom Caucus will like it. We will get to this. We will get to some of the legal ramifications for President Trump. With this new polling that we talked about, one of the things that's striking is how many people who are currently supporting Trump, that 45.1% as an average of the polling, how many of those people would say they wouldn't support him if he is found guilty of a felony, which he's on trial for right now? We will get to that with John Yoo, law professor from University of California, Berkeley, leading conservative legal scholar. That and more coming up.
Michael, this is the best show.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
From politics to pop culture and from coast to coast, this is The Michael Medved Show.
And on The Michael Medved Show, it looks almost certain that Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, is going to have a major success for our country, for the Republican Party, and for his own survival as Speaker. They are going to vote on Saturday night, at least is the schedule, on three separate bills providing desperately needed aid for Ukraine, for Israel, and for the Indo-Pacific, including Taiwan. And all of this has already been passed by the Senate, and it's very important. Some of the Republican reaction to that is comes from Chip Roy in Texas, is very hostile about it. He says the Republican Speaker of the House is seeking a rule to pass almost $100 billion in foreign aid while an unquestionably dangerous criminals, terrorists, and fentanyl pour across our border. The border vote in this package is a watered-down, dangerous cover vote I will oppose. If they had only passed previously the compromise sweeping bill, supplemental bill, that had been negotiated so skillfully by the very conservative Senator Lankford from Oklahoma, that would have already gone into action, and some of the border reforms that Representative Chip Roy, pardon me, is concerned about would have been dealt with. Representative Troy Neals of Texas earlier called aid to Ukraine totally unnecessary, and ask some of the Ukrainians who are running out of ammunition to even fight back against the persistent Russian invasion. He says, I'm not giving them a nickel. Not today, not tomorrow, not next week. Well, how about the week after next? Here's how he explains it. Putin is not going into Poland. I don't care what you say. Besides, anyway, it doesn't really matter because when Donald Trump wins, Putin's leaving. Putin's leaving Ukraine. And then the report says Congressman Neals said this before the bill's release without explaining his logic. His logic is that President Trump has said that Putin never would have invaded if he had still been president. So naturally, Putin will withdraw if he wins the election. Let us hope that Putin doesn't just withdraw, but that he is beaten back. Part of the confusion and the difficulty that we're facing from both sides, and this is why, frankly, most of the American people have very limited confidence in Joe Biden and very limited confidence in Donald Trump. But there is an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that everyone should pay some attention to because it goes right down to that point of view that a lot of people hold. No one wants to see an expansion of the war in the Middle East. And right now, the war cabinet in Israel has been meeting every day. They have not decided on what their response is going to be to the rocket and missile and drone attack by Iran that, with the help of the United States of America and Britain and France and Saudi Arabia and Jordan, they were able to shoot down most of those missiles with minimal damage being done to Israel. But the idea that this was a serious matter, there are pictures that have come out of Israel. We should post some of them if we can, Jeremy, showing these gigantic missiles that actually were shot down. But we're talking about huge. We're talking about the size of a 16-wheeler truck. And no, these are not little fireworks. In any event, the Wall Street Journal writes, President Biden's strategy of pressuring Israel and pleading with Hamas for a ceasefire and hostage deal has met one more dead end. Hamas rejected another offer over the weekend, countering with new demands designed to throw negotiations into disarray. Hamas now demands a six-week truce in which it releases no hostages while Israel stops fighting, withdraws from the Gaza's cities, and commits to a permanent ceasefire, a withdrawal from Gaza, and the return of all Palestinians, including Hamas, to northern Gaza. In other words, they demand an Israeli surrender, which they will not get. After months of negotiations over the release of 40 hostages among the women, older men, and the sick, Hamas now says it can produce only 20, and it wants far more Palestinian terrorists in return. It demands 30 Palestinians imprisoned in Israel for each civilian hostage and 50 for each captive female Israeli soldier, including 30 terrorists. These are the people they demand to be released who are serving life sentences. The only way you get a life sentence in Israel is if you're involved in murder, and those 30 people are. There is no capital punishment in Israel, which is one of the reasons that they've accumulated those 30 terrorists that Hamas wants back. Mr. Biden staked his Gaza strategy on coercing Israel to make the concessions to get a deal and ceasefire. But the holdup wasn't on the Israeli side. The more desperate the president appeared for a ceasefire, the more distant it became. When he blamed Israel for all civilian suffering and demanded new Israeli concessions, Hamas raised its demands. Hamas scorns a deal because the president has given it reason to expect to get the ceasefire at once without releasing any hostages. Mr. Biden had been slowly delinking the two while creating a public breach with Israel. Doubtless he thought about the signal these steps would send to Dearborn, Michigan. Did he think about the signal he is sending to Hamas about the five American hostages who may still be alive? Hamas is unlikely to cut a deal until it feels the knife on its neck, as it did when Israel stormed Gaza City. That yielded the release of 105 hostages. But since Mr. Biden declared himself protector of Rafah, Hamas's final stronghold, and Israel has withdrawn most of its troops, the odds of a deal have declined. So what about some plea deal regarding President Trump or the future of his legal cases that are mounting up? We'll talk about that with Professor John Yu coming up later on the Michael Medved Show.
Love him.
I love your show.
Or hate him.
Well, I start to think that you're going to start to feel nice. You turn me.
Just keep listening.
I listen to this show 4 hours a day.
To Michael Medved.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there is more about the world waiting for an Israeli decision about what they do next against Iran. The United States is cooperating, at least to the extent of imposing some new sanctions on Iran that are fairly serious, that may further damage that economy. President Ebrahim Raisi, who spoke today, he spoke at an annual army parade that was moved from its original location in Iran to a barracks north of the capital, Tehran, from its usual venue on a highway in the city's southern outskirts. Iranian authorities gave no explanation for its relocation, and state television didn't broadcast it live as it has in previous years. Look, it's fairly obvious why they would move it away from a highway on the outskirts of town. I mean, would that be an inviting target or what? When it's being broadcast live and you can get the location exactly? Because remember, when you're talking about missiles, the distance between Tehran and Tel Aviv, it's a matter of minutes. So who knows what kind of parade. Obviously, the parade will have death to America, death to America, death to America, and death to Israel. In Iranian propaganda, America is the great Satan, and Israel has to accept the position of the little Satan. And Elliot Kaufman, who is the letters editor at the Wall Street Journal, has a piece under the heading, Israel Has No Choice But to Strike Back. Now, what does that mean and why? He writes that to learn the lessons of October 7th is to reject the advice after the long night of April 13th. Israel will respond to Iran, it announced Monday. It has learned the hard way that air defenses don't relieve you of the duty to subdue a determined attacker. Hamas's intent to slaughter Israelis was hardly a secret, but Israel allowed it to survive and grow stronger because its rockets could be intercepted. It was no harm, no foul. Israel agreed to take the win, in quotes, against Hamas. As Mr. Biden now advises with regard to Iran, they took the win all the way to catastrophe. Rocket fire from an Iranian proxy became normal, not worth a response in most cases until it was too late. It's the same story with Hezbollah, whose expanding arsenal and occasional rocket fire became facts of life in northern Israel. Another war would have been costly, and what damage were the rockets really doing in the meantime? As the smart set says about Iran today, Hezbollah's attacks were merely, quote, symbolic. Israel never stopped the trickle, so it became a flood. Hezbollah has fired on Israel more than 3,000 times since October 7th, depopulating the country's north. And that is not permanently. People are planning to return to their homes. I actually know some of those people. And there's 60,000 people who have been relocated from homes in northern Israel. And Elliot Kaufman writes that they depopulating the country's north, yet this too has become normal. Man is a creature who can get used to anything, writes Dostoevsky. And all the more so if it's the other guy who has to live with the consequences. Biden administration officials now regularly implore Israel not to escalate with Hezbollah. That, they say, would cause a war. The miracle of Iron Dome air defenses for years led Israel to tolerate what no other nation on earth would. Worse, other nations demanded that Israel tolerate it, because Israel suffered little damage. When Hamas crossed a line and Israel responded, as in 2008 and 2014, the world quickly came to demand a ceasefire, no matter how strong and unbound Hamas remained. Better to restore calm. Better to have peace and quiet. Today, many restrainers assure us that Iran's attack on Israel was just a mere demonstration, nothing demanding a reply. Never mind that it was the largest drone attack in all of human history, plus 150 so ballistic and cruise missiles. When it wanted to put on a show in January, after Israel had killed a different Iranian terror kingpin. Iran fired 11 missiles at an Iraqi businessman's family home and called it a Mossad base. This wasn't that. The administration, the Biden administration, is proud of its back-channel work, but it shouldn't be. Instead of reassuring Iran that it could attack Israel within parameters, Mr. Biden should have left Ayatollah Ali Khamenei fearing how the U.S. would reply. In telling Israel to move on, Mr. Biden is asking it to recognize Iran's right to respond to pinpoint strikes in Syria with war on the Israeli homeland. As the head of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said Sunday, from now on, if the Zionist regime anywhere attacks our interests, assets, figures, and citizens, we will reciprocally attack it from Iran. Israel is being told again to let the problem fester and to accept a tit-for-tat equation, but on worse terms than ever. It's only 100 ballistic missiles. It's only the latest gruel to swallow. While Mr. Khamenei releases ravings, such as on April 10th, about Israeli normalization with Muslim states. Quote, the Zionists suck the blood of a country for their own benefit when they gain a foothold. The world brushes off the anti-Semitism. The media don't even report his statements. Mr. Biden asks Israel to put its faith in deterrence while its enemies become stronger. And Israel is the one deterred. When the president threatens that Israel will be isolated on its own if it defends itself properly, he is asking it to stick to the strategy that left it fatally exposed on October 7th, and that it swore off the same day. Look, this is tremendously important, and it's one of those things where this is an opportunity for Joe Biden to demonstrate some leadership. And some of that leadership is obviously going to offend some of the crazies in his own party. But one of the points that Molly Ball makes, columnist, journalist, is that what Biden has to do, if he wants to even compete successfully in this election, is he has to go after the middle, the independents, and not be obsessed with radicals and pro-Hamas protesters in Dearborn, Michigan, and elsewhere. We'll be right back on the MedVed Show.
MedVed doesn't behave himself. You can't reason with him. He's opinionated, and you can't tell him that he's wrong.
This is the Michael MedVed Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, as you probably know already, because it's been occupying people's time and energy and effort and focus all week, but today was the day when the Senate was finally convening the trial of Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, for his impeachment. And the Senate has just voted. And again, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate Majority Leader, had said he was going to dispense with this question of impeachment fairly quickly. He appears to be keeping his promise. The breaking news just now, the Senate has voted that the first article of impeachment against Secretary Mayorkas is unconstitutional. And the vote was 51 to 48. It was all the Democrats and the independents who caucus with the Democrats voting to drop that first article of impeachment, and 48 Republicans voting no. The 49th Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who has indicated fairly decisively that she's not going to vote to convict Mayorkas and to drive him from office, she voted present. That's why you have, with all of the senators there, you have only 99 votes, not 100. The vote 51-48 in favor of the idea that the first article of impeachment is unconstitutional. Here is what some of the debate sounded like moments ago.
Responded, President.
Let us listen to Patty Murray.
The point of order is well taken and the article falls.
Madam President.
Majority Leader is recognized.
I raise a point of order that impeachment Article 2 does not allege conduct that rises to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor as required under Article 2, Section 4 of the United States Constitution and is therefore unconstitutional.
Madam President.
Okay, that was the same basis in which they found the first article of impeachment unconstitutional. They're now moving on to the second article of impeachment. The idea that this is going to be some kind of political victory or that it's going to change the Biden administration's policy on border security, none of that is going to happen. This was a foolish, foolish impeachment drive. Just as the first impeachment drive was against President Trump, because there was no chance of passage. There was no chance of conviction. You're not going to get two-thirds of the Senate to vote. In other words, they have a majority of the Senate now, 51 votes. That's a majority that want to drop the charges, not just find them to vote them down. The vote would have been even more lopsided if it had been a vote to dispense with the impeachment altogether. The Senate has voted to kill the first article of impeachment, which claims that he should be impeached, Secretary Mayorkas, for willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law. If there were willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law, wouldn't it be appropriate to demand that the president of the United States drop him from the cabinet? And that's why we haven't had any other members of the cabinet who have been successfully impeached. When William Belknap, and I've written about this, it's up, I think some of our commentary is up at Substack, that William Belknap was Secretary of War in the Grant administration and something of a Civil War hero who had worked and fought with Grant. But he was impeached, but he resigned before they could bring any charges against him. And he was impeached because of taking money from people who were selling things in federal forts. It was tawdry. The Senate Majority Leader on the Senate floor laid out his proposed rules for a speedy impeachment trial. This is clip three.
I will ask unanimous consent to allow for debate time, to allow for Republicans to offer and have votes on trial resolutions, and allow for Republicans to offer and have votes on points of order. So, I ask unanimous consent that Senator Lee be recognized to offer a resolution that is the text of S-Res 624, the full Senate trial. That Senator Cruz be recognized to offer a resolution that is the text of S-Res 622, the trial committee. that there then be up to 60 minutes of debate on the resolutions concurrently and equally divided between the two leaders or their designees, and following the use or yielding back of that time, the Senate vote on or in relation to the resolutions in the order listed, with no amendments to the resolutions in order.
Okay, again, this is a desire to have the Senate move on to other more pressing business. Concerning pressing business, we've spoken earlier this week about the new statistics on crime that are incredibly encouraging in the country, particularly on homicide. And one of the things that had happened is we had been getting lower and lower crime rates. Then during the period of the pandemic, crime rates went up, and that was partially associated with the reaction to George Floyd's killing, where there was so much defund the police and crippling of police departments. And as a number of commentators have put it, the police departments went to sleep. They were actually maybe given sleeping pills by some of the political activists on the left. But crime went up. Homicides went up, but now it has gone down more sharply than at any time since the 1990s. So you're talking about mid-1990s, you're talking about 30 years. And right now I have a piece at Substack, which I think is very important and important for people to take a look at. It's called Good News on Crime Demands Fresh Perspective on Immigration. Why? How? Because right now, is immigration down or is it up? It's way up. The levels of immigration, including illegal immigration, have gone way high at the end of the pandemic, because the pandemic, during the pandemic, there was very low levels of immigration, not only because of tough enforcement provisions that were put in place by Trump, but because the economy was terrible and there were no jobs for people, and because there were public health restrictions that made illegal immigration more difficult. So wait, let's just talk for a moment here. You've got a situation where immigration goes down during the pandemic at the same time that crime goes way up. And now you have a situation where immigration is way up and crime is way down. In Philadelphia, for instance, the murder rate in 1 year has dropped 35%. Nationwide, it's dropped more than 20% in 133 leading cities. I write about that on Substack and explain what's going on. We are going to be joined coming up by Molly Ball, who attended Trump's trial yesterday, can talk about what we know about the members of the jury who have been approved so far. Molly Ball writes about what Biden needs to do differently if he wants to continue having the momentum that the recent polls show, or he wants to actually win the election. What he has to do is not cater to the left in his own party, but to go after that crucial vote in the center, the independent voter. So how does he appeal to those people? How would Trump appeal to those people? We will get to that and more with Molly Ball coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.